On Debt, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Debt, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its author's intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special 2-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
You're listening to Working, the podcast for what people do all day. I'm Jacob Brogan. This season on Working, we've been talking about the working lives of animals. And in this episode, we heard about dogs who perform on Broadway. To that end, we were joined by Bill Berlone, who's been training animals to perform for around 40 years. He talked to us about a dog that he works with, or has been working with recently, named Bodhi, who's performing in a production of a musical production of Because of Winn-Dixie. In that show, Bodhi has more than 100 cues, more than 100 things that he has to do on stage. Bill talks us through how he trains a dog like Bodhi, prepare him to do that kind of work in the first place, leads us through a day in the life as this canine actor prepares to go on stage, talks to us about how the production itself works, and much, much more. Then in a Slate Plus Extra, Bill Berlone talks to us about some of the other animals that he's trained over the years. For that and other great Slate Plus Extras, you can start your 2-week free trial at slate.com/workingplus. What is your animal's name and what does it do?
My animal's name is Bodhi, and he's a canine theatrical actor.
A canine theatrical actor. So that means he is a dog who performs on stage.
Correct.
What is your name and what do you do? What is your relationship to Bodhi?
My name is Bill Berlone, and I'm a theatrical animal trainer. And Bodhi is one of the 31 dogs that my wife and I own and train for Broadway shows.
That is a lot of dogs.
And they all live in our house.
I hope it's a really big house.
It is a really big house. We have a beautiful farm up in Connecticut on 90 acres. And the house is theirs, and we just sort of live in it with them.
Co-occupy.
Yes.
With the pups. 31. Sorry, I'm still wrapping my mind around 31 dogs. Okay, so Bodhi is a canine theatrical actor. He lives with a whole bunch of other dogs that are also canine theatrical actors?
Yes.
Is that fair to say? What sort of acting does a canine theatrical actor do?
Well, there are a number of Broadway shows that have characters in them who are portrayed by animals. And Bodhi is the latest of our menagerie who's starring in a new musical based on the book Because of Winn-Dixie, and the musical's called Because of Winn-Dixie, and he plays Winn-Dixie.
So remind me, who is Winn-Dixie? What is this story?
It's a children's book by the famed author Kate DiCarmelo, and it's required fourth grade reading in every school in the United States. And it's a very popular book, and it was turned into a mediocre movie, and my wife and I have acquired the rights and have turned it into a musical.
Uh-huh. And the protagonist is a dog, or did you just change the details there?
No, the protagonist is a dog. The whole idea is it's the first theatrical event to star a dog. For years, I've been training dogs to play characters, but now we're training one to be the star.
Well, all right. So let's talk about that. What you've been doing for a long time first. What does it take to train a dog to be a character on stage?
It takes a whole different type of outlook into training than conventional training, whether it be for movies or for service dogs or whatever. When I was 19 years old, I trained the original Sandy in the original production of Annie on Broadway. And up until the musical Annie, a dog had never played a character because people thought, well, you can't depend on any animal to do the same thing 8 times a week in front of a live audience. Except nobody told me that, and nobody told the creators of Annie that. So I went to an animal shelter and adopted a sandy-colored mutt and trained him as I had trained my own pets growing up. And in the spring of 1977, Annie opened on Broadway and became, you know, a huge phenomenon, and I became a world-famous animal trainer for providing this dog that went on stage every night and did the same thing. So my career has been built off of that, and we're now just taking it to new heights.
So if I'm understanding right, it's not just that you're teaching a dog a few, you know, spectacular tricks that it can do on command. It's also about – when you say you're teaching these dogs to be characters, you're teaching them to be present on stage in the role that they have been assigned, which sounds like a much more complex form of training than just a set of, you know, literal hoops to literally leap through, as it were.
That's a good way to describe it. People thought I was out of my mind because if we own a pet, we know that any given moment we can't force our animal to do anything we want it to do. So why would someone try to put an animal on stage in which a $12 million musical is depending upon what that animal is going to do? Because, you know, it's not like film where you only need to get it right once for the right take. You know, in theater, people have paid good money to see a show and have a story be told. So why would we depend on an animal to do that? In my experience, what I've discovered is that they're actually more reliable than the human actors.
How so?
Well, you know, animals don't have cognitive thought process. If you create a pleasant situation for them with a series of behaviors and rewards, they'll gladly do it. I mean, as long as they're healthy and happy, they'll do it. Actors come in. They've had a bad night. They're hungover. They've broken up with a spouse. I mean, and it affects their performance. Whereas the dogs are just like, where's the cookie? And, you know, they move on to the next thing.
So you're saying that dogs don't get an ego after everyone claps for them?
No, not at all.
That's almost a shame.
I know.
Probably makes your job easier and maybe makes Bodhi's job easier. You know, looking back, you said when you first did that production of Annie, you went and you adopted a appropriate-looking mutt from a shelter. Is this something that any dog can theoretically be taught to do? Can any dog be taught to be a character on stage with the proper training?
No. You know, as an animal behaviorist, I have learned that we really can't control nature. And that some animals are more suited for one job than another. You know, that's obviously apparent when you're thinking about service dogs or protection dogs. You know, they have to have the right personality to do that work. Well, the same thing for acting dogs. They have to have the right personality to be on stage. They have to be outgoing. They have to be friendly. Mm-hmm. They have to be gregarious. You know, you can't teach those personality traits to a dog that doesn't have them. So while, you know, everybody will say to me, oh, I've got this really talented dog. He does these tricks in my living room. And I'll go, okay, step outside your front door and try those same tricks and see if it happens. And most of the time it doesn't.
How do you tell when you're looking at a young dog, this animal might be good for this kind of work?
Well, it sort of goes with my philosophy. All the animals I train are shelter dogs. They're rescue dog. I've trained somewhere over 230 dogs in my career so far. And the biggest thing that show business provides is a stressful situation. So we want to make sure we find a dog who can deal with stress and not be overwhelmed or become aggressive over that stress. And unfortunately, an animal shelter is a very stressful place. You know, so this is advice for people who are looking to adopt a dog. When you go into a shelter, there's usually three types of dogs. There's the dog who is cowering in the back of the cage, who isn't dealing well with the stress of that whole situation. There's the dog who's at the front of the cage barking, you know, to get out, let me out, hey, here I am, and drawing all that attention to themselves, and that's how they deal with stress. I look for the dogs who are just sort of sitting there and dealing with it, taking it all in. That says to me that in very stressful situations, that dog can remain calm and composed. You know, so number one is how they deal with stress. Number two is that they have to like people. You know, you go into the cage, and if the dog comes up to you and introduces himself and wants to interact with you, that's usually a good sign that he'll enjoy this sort of work because it's all – he'll be surrounded by a lot of people. You know, and third, that they're motivated to do something. So whether it's motivated for food or motivated with a toy, there's something that they like that we could use to teach them these new behaviors.
Mm-hmm. What was it like with Bodhi, since we're talking in part about him? At what point did you look at Bodhi and say, like, this dog is going to be a real star? I mean, was it at the shelter or did that come later?
It actually was part of the development of the musical. The story of Because of Winn-Dixie is about a girl and her father who comes to a southern town. He's a preacher. Mother has left them because she's an alcoholic, and she goes to the Winn-Dixie food store and she finds this giant dog, which she brings home and against the father's approval. And through a series of events, the dog changes their lives, changes the lives of others in town. So the book had this giant shaggy dog. So our first thought, my wife and I, was to use Irish wolfhounds. So we adopted two Irish wolfhounds because they're gentle giants, 180 pounds of pure love, great with kids.
And wonderful dogs. So we live next to one.
I know. So we did our first out-of-town tryout, and as sweet as they were, they're very lazy.
They are. It's true.
They got on stage, and they just like laid down. They were like, no, we're going to take a break now. And it was a painful experience to go through because they were big and lazy. So I was like, okay, so we need dogs that are a little more motivated. And but it had to look sort of muddish. And we started looking at golden doodles, poodle mixes with crazy hair, you know, those big dogs. And we found Bodhi online. He was up for adoption from a home in Utah where the family couldn't keep this big dog. He was out of control, and I flew out to meet him, and I recognized that he was friendly. He was good with kids. He was just smarter than his owners. So I thought he'd be perfect for the job.
I hope they don't listen to this.
Well, no, and they admitted it. They were looking, you know, to place him in a good home, and they recognized that I could, as a trainer, bring out all the goodness in him instead of, you know, the mischief.
Sure.
So we actually, in the development of the musical, went from getting away from hounds, you know, and going to more working dogs.
So once you've found this dog, we brought him back to Connecticut.
Yep.
How did you start training him for a specific show? I mean, he's going to have to interact with human actors. Will he be interacting with other dogs in the show as well?
In most plays, there was only one musical I did on Broadway, which was a musical based on Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. in which we had 8 dogs that had to work in a pack and run on stage and cause chaos and then run off stage. Most of them are, you know, work singularly as a character, whether it's an Annie or the Wizard of Oz or, but you know, as a dog trainer who uses positive reinforcement, what I try to educate people about is that you shouldn't teach your dog tricks to do things just to amuse you. I teach my dogs that it's fun to listen to humans. Now, two very different things. Because if you teach them that it's fun to listen to humans, they become interested and want to do more for you because they want to have more fun. We all want to have more fun. So we start with basic obedience. You know, here was a dog or who had just run a household, so he was in control. And we had to teach him that, no, you know, if you listen to us, there's going to be more cookies involved than if you don't.
What does that mean, teaching him to listen to you? I mean, like, fun to, means something slightly different to dog.
Yeah, pay attention. You know, instead of you being the boss, I'll be the boss, and we'll do things together, and you'll get rewards for them. So, you know, you can do that with what's called basic obedience. I mean, you can go to, you know, a dog training school and teach your dog how to listen to you, how to walk by your side, how to sit, how to stay, how to come when you call them. Most people fail at it. But, you know, if you're persistent with it, the dog learns that you're in control and, oh, it's better to listen than not. So we spend – that's the hardest part, you know, taking dogs who have been abandoned or out of control and sort of taking them away from the dark side, bringing them into the light and being good canine citizens. Because once you've done that, then you start laying in the behaviors that they have to do in the show. And so that's the sort of the first two steps. The third step is socialization. You know, because again, if I just practiced in my training room, Bodhi would learn to do it in my training room, and then I'd get him to the theater, and he'd be like, "What? We don't practice here." So we start taking the dogs out and having them do behaviors in different places. You know, there are many stores like Petco and Home Depot and Bed Bath and Beyond that allow dogs. So you know, you walk in with your dog, and you just start doing some basic stuff, and they start learning that, oh, I have to learn when there are others' distractions around. Once you get to that step, the third step for us, the fourth step is we bring them to shows that are actually running so that they get desensitized to the sound of applause, to orchestras, to things flying over their heads and stagehands moving stuff backstage. So if a dog goes through all those steps and still is having fun, then we're pretty sure that it's going to be successful in a theatrical production. If
do you ever get to that stage, though, and find that a dog is actually not ready and have to start over?
We usually find out in step three when we're taking them out in public, you know, and they're too distracted by everything going on. And at that point, you know, knowing that they're not going to be a canine performer, we'll usually find them a home because by then we know they're a great pet. They're just not. They don't want to get on stage and tap dance, you know, so we find them, we rehome them. But yeah, I would say about 5% of the time, the dogs that I pick that I think are going to work end up just being great dogs and not performers.
And then at some point, you've got to do a generic show. They've experienced Broadway. They've been under the lights. They've seen what it's like backstage. They've heard the orchestra, the applause. What's the next step after that?
Then we actually go into rehearsal for the play. And when I was 19 years old, I was studying to be an actor. So I had a lot of onstage experience. So when they asked me to train a dog, I was thinking, okay, well, but I'm the trainer and I'm in the wings and we can't see the dog looking in the wings and getting a command and executing it. That would be just dumb. So I said, well, we have to train the actors to be trainers. And everybody thought I was crazy. And that meant we had to take a little 10-year-old girl and have the dog fall in love with her, work with her, and she had to be as adept at training as we were so that the dog listened to her. And we were successful at that. So there's another component in which we go into rehearsal, and now the characters who interact with the dog are the main character. We have to turn them into trainers because – on a film, I can be back, you know, I just did a film with Julia Roberts and I was standing behind her off camera and the dog was doing behaviors and it looked to the camera and to the audience like he was listening to Julia. You can do that in film. You can't do that in theater. And that's sort of the thing that people didn't think about. That's the hardest part because, you know, actors don't always have great dog skills. And we have to turn them into trainers. Otherwise, the dog isn't going to perform. And that's what we do in the 6 to 8 weeks of rehearsal prior to the opening of a performance.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Is a dog's day different on a day that it's going to perform than it would be when it's at home with 30 other pups barking and making chaos or whatever they do?
A little bit. And again, people think that, you know, we spend all our time putting the dogs through military drills and keeping them trained and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, we ask them to have fun and we want them to, A, be in perfect health. You know, when you have a $12 million show and you can't come in and say, oh, the dog's sick, we have to cancel, you know, you'll end up in a lawsuit. So you have to keep the dog healthy. You have to keep them happy. Keeping them in crates or keeping them in runs would just make them crazy. So they have to be sort of relaxed. And the other interesting thing is we sort of keep them a little bit bored. Like their day is just hanging out, you know, sleeping on the couch, going for walks, so that when they get to the theater, that's the fun place to be. I go to the theater and there are 35 people who like me and pet me and I'm going to listen to my main character and get lots of cookies and, you know, so 20 hours of the day, they're just sort of just chilling, hanging out. And then they go to the theater and they have a great time. Because the thing that, you know, I think the audience should be aware of is that working dogs, that term working dogs, there's no creature on this earth that walks up to man and says, turn me into a slave, make me work.
Sure.
We enslave animals to do things for us. And that's a huge responsibility. And I take that very seriously. And I don't want to do that. I want to create situations where animals have fun and as a result do things for us. So if it isn't fun, we would never force our animals to work. And I don't think anybody would want to force animals to work. And you know, throughout the history of man, we've exploited the earth, we've exploited animals for our own needs. But, you know, we're in a different time, and certainly in a situation like this where it's just entertainment, it's got to be fun. You know, Bodhi didn't walk up to me and say, make me a star, I want to work 40 hours a week and live in New York City. I mean, he didn't say that. So if it isn't fun for them during the day, if they aren't relaxed, if they don't drag me into the theater to want to do what they have to do, then we shouldn't be doing it.
But there are also practical questions here, right? You know, that if they're going to eat a lot of treats during the show, what do they eat during the day? I mean, are they also – I mean, I'm sure you're not starving them, of course. But,
no.
But are you is on the day of a show, is Bodhi eating less than he would otherwise to prepare for his enormous – no?
No. You know, again, it's really sort of common sense. You know, recommended that you feed your dog twice a day, you know, every 12 hours so that instead of once a day, so their stomach doesn't end up empty for such a long time. So you feed them twice a day. So most people feed their dogs, you know, before they go to work and at supper time. So 8 a.m. and 6 p.m. I feed my dogs, you know, 12 noon and midnight so that at 8 p.m. right before the show, there's a little twinge of hunger, you know, another thing we think about is that, you know, I hate obesity in animals. You know, it just shortens their life. So we're very cautious about their weight. And if we know we have a working dog and he's got – he eats 4 cups of food a day and we're giving him a cup of treats a day, then we, you know, we only give him 3 cups of food so that we maintain the same caloric intake so that they don't get obese. But again, we don't we don't starve them to perform. But, you know, I'm when I'm hungry, I'm a little more focused for dinner, you know. So that's sort of the common sense theory that we use.
If we're talking about Bodhi in particular, does he have particular treats that he likes? I mean, a lot of dog treats are pretty high caloric by dog standards, I think, right? Is there a good balance between treats that are relatively good for him and treats that he actually seems to enjoy eating that function as a good reward for him?
Yes. And a lot of the things we're going to talk about, again, are common sense tips that all pet owners should think about. When you're training, treats have value like money, okay? Mm-hmm. People go out and buy these high-end treats and they walk into their home and like the dog greets them and they give them a high-end treat, you know, something really tasty. And then they wonder why the dog doesn't do anything just for, you know, when you ask it to. So when we're training, we just use their regular dog food, you know, in the beginning. And that's good enough. They're happy with that. And then as the distractions sort of start pouring in, we start upping the value and the taste and quality of the treat so that it helps focus them, you know, so that, you know, by the time we get to the actual performance, if there's something really, really difficult in the show, for that we might use a piece of steak, you know, like if there's there's one trick that sort of is imperative, really imperative to the story. So, you know, that's the highest end treat. The rest of them are just sort of, you know, oh, this is good stuff and better than I get during the day. So, you know, again, I remind people that, you know, you should only give your dogs treats when they do something for you. And again, save the really good stuff for the important stuff, you know, the more important behaviors.
So, okay, so we've talked about eating. It sounds like it gets some kind of not particularly exciting walks. The treats, especially the important treats on a show day, are going to be saved for the actual performance itself.
Yep.
At what point does Bodhi or another dog actually show up to the theater? When's his call time?
His call. Well, it's interesting. We start preparing maybe 2 or 3 hours before. One of the biggest questions I get in interviews is, has a dog ever gone to the bathroom on stage? And of course, if I were an irresponsible trainer and made sure my dog didn't empty themselves out before they went to the show, that would probably happen. But, you know, 2 or 3 hours before, it's like we go for a walk and make sure that you're sort of emptied. Then, you know, we wherever we are, we have to drive the dogs. You can't take animals on subways or mass transit. So then we have to get the car, get to the theater. They're very happy to see everybody. They say hello to the crew. They say hello. And then we need to sort of like, okay, now let's calm down. Let's focus. And then we do a warm-up session with the actors who are going to be performing with them that night to remind the dog and the actors what they're doing that night. And that's usually about an hour before the performance, you know, hour to half hour. And then we bring them to the dressing room and just sort of let them chill. I mean, so they've said hello to everybody. They've had some fun. They've been reminded what they're going to do. And then they just sort of chill. And then the overture starts and they get up and walk to the door and, you know, they're ready to go.
And then in a show like Winn-Dixie, how much time is Bodhi spending on stage?
Well, that's the amazing thing about this particular performance. When I trained the original Sandy, Sandy became a big star. I mean, we went to the White House 5 times. He had his own autobiography. He was invited all over Broadway because he was the first canine actor. He only had 12 cues on stage, and he was only in Annie for a total of 9.5 minutes.
What do you mean by cue here?
A behavior. You know, entering to the stage and lying down, you know, staying during the song, jumping up at a certain, you know, I mean, he only had like 9 of those. 40 years later, I've learned a little bit more. So in because of Winn-Dixie, Bodhi now has 110 cues.
Sounds like a lot.
He's on stage, yeah, something like 100 minutes out of a 120-minute show.
Wow.
And it takes four trainers to create that performance. There's two of us off stage. One of my trainers is actually on stage as an actor doing internal cues, and then the main actress, the young girl who's actually handling him most of the time. So it's a hybrid of this work that I started 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the things that he's doing on stage during that performance? What skills or cues has he had to
learn? Well, interestingly enough, the hardest thing to do is nothing. Dogs tend to upstage action when they're on stage, you know. So teaching him to come on stage and lie down for a musical number or for a scene, you know, and not look around and scratch himself and roll over and, you know, just getting him to stay still is a cue. But there's a lot of going from point A to point B, carrying things, identifying people, doing what dogs normally do, but at the exact moment in the story to move it forward. Barks on command.
Does he ever sing along during
the
songs?
No. You know, when we were writing this musical, we thought we could either make it Disney-esque, like we say. We could have made Winn-Dixie a character, you know, and had him do amazing tricks. Or we chose to make him act like a normal dog so that people could identify with that character, as opposed to saying, wow, look at what that dog did. We want them to say, well, my dog does the same thing. So, you know, the greatest example we use is at one point our main character breaks down and cries. In a Disney film, the dog would go over and get a Kleenex box and bring it over. In real life, when we cry, our dog comes over and puts their head on our lap. You know, so training him to do that, you know. Yeah. So it's those sort of things that you don't recognize but are actually pretty detailed in training.
So it's really about creating a kind of naturalistic instead of spectacular form of
yes.
dog acting.
Yes.
You're trying to train the dog to do what a dog might do under these actual circumstances were this in fact a real
Correct.
Circumstance.
Except they're not real and the emotions aren't there, so they're all set up.
Right.
So it's really a trained behavior.
Yeah.
So, you know, here's a little trade secret. You know, when the girl breaks down and cries, I tell him to go lick the peanut butter off of her face behind her ear. I mean, so, you know, he's sitting there salivating while she's singing the song.
Oh, God.
Waiting. So, you know, but that's how we create those illusions, you know.
Right.
So during the number, he's focused and the audience is like, wow, he's really listening. And then as soon as she puts her head down and starts to cry, I release him from a stay command and he comes over and he starts kissing her, you know.
Oh, gosh.
So so that's the sort of thing that we do. And again, it's fun. You know, it's not like go over there and lick her, you know.
Dogs are generally pretty emotionally sensitive around humans, pretty attuned to our states because of the long history of domestication. But is it ever strange for them to be in this synthetic emotional environment of a theater show? Does that ever throw them off their own emotional game, do you think?
Very much so. And again, as their guardian, I have to protect against them against that. For example, when an actor is acting angrily, a dog might become fearful. It would become fearful if somebody started yelling in a room, you know. So we have a main character. We have a character in Winn-Dixie who has to yell during one of the scenes, you know. So what we did was we desensitized Bodhi to this actor. And what we basically taught Bodhi was that, yeah, this guy might get loud sometime. So, you know, as a training technique, every time this actor comes to rehearsal, instead of going, hey, Bodhi, how are you? He comes, hey, how? And he acts that big voice while he's petting him so that the dog learns that, oh, that's not a real emotion. That's a fake emotion. But the interesting thing about that is when the hardest part in our training is opening night, you know, humans put a lot of value on opening night. And dogs are so in tune to us and our bodies and our sense that, you know, when we're fearful, our body creates adrenaline, you know, and our body chemistry changes. When we're overly excited and nervous for opening night, our body creates adrenaline and our body chemistry changes. And so dogs often interpret opening nights as, why is everybody so fearful? Why is everybody so worried? It smells different, you know, and they and I literally have to have a meeting before the opening night and go, okay, everybody on stage with the dog, take a deep breath. Take a deep breath. You cannot go there. You cannot let these nerves that usually are reserved for opening nights happen because you will scare our dog. He will think there's something, you know, wrong and it will throw him off. And, you know, it's just interesting that people, of course, when you say it, it makes sense. But to say to an actor, you have to stay calm for the dog is something they're not usually accustomed to hearing. So we do take those emotions into consideration all the time.
Yeah, yeah. Once a show, a performance of a show is over, when, you know, this 120 minutes plus intermission, whatever it is, applause, audience finally files out. What's the evening like? Or I guess if it's a matinee, the afternoon, like afterward for a dog like Bodhi?
We have to sneak them out of the theater like some rock star.
Because everyone wants to shake their paw?
Well, yeah.
Paw.
And, you know, if you've been to a Broadway show or any performance where there's the fans are outside the stage door, actors relish in all that attention and signing autographs. Dogs seeing people rush toward them, reaching out to touch them, is very frightening. You know,
sure.
So as much as we'd like to thank our fans, we have to like sneak the dog out. So and then they go home and they have their dinner. If it's an evening show, if it's a matinee, they take a nap in between. We wait till the crowds disperse, go out for another walk, make sure we're emptied for the evening show, you know, and then do a warm up. So it's not as exciting as one would think. But, you know, we treat these dogs like Olympic athletes. You know, they have to be in the best state of mind, the best physical condition, you know, and pumped and ready to do their job.
How many shows can a dog like Bodhi do a week? And does he get exhausted if he doesn't have time off?
Usually, most theatrical productions will do 8 shows a week. So we've actually worked that backwards to make sure that we haven't created a show that's so taxing that by show number 6, he's exhausted. But the original Sandy did 2,233 performances of the original show on Broadway and never missed a performance. Ran for 8 years, and he showed up every night, had a good time. So if it's fun, you know, they'll stick with it.
How do they get these jobs in the first place? I mean, you have been doing this for a long time. Is it just that casting directors, producers come to you and say, this is the dog we need? Or are they like, that particular dog is the dog we need? Are they asking you to figure everything out, or do they cast for particular animals?
Writers will write a story. Producers will choose to do it. If it has an animal in it, the producers are usually unhappy. And then they'll call me, and I begin the process of working with the creators, saying what's possible and what isn't. You know, because again, you want people to be creative, and most of our collective visualizations of animal performances are from what we see in films, and that can't always be replicated exactly 8 times a week in front of a live audience. So I have to then say, well, how do we make that same message with a canine, you know? Figure it out. And 10 years ago, I did a musical based on the movie Legally Blonde. And its main character, Elle Wood, had a little chihuahua named Bruiser. And the creators of the musical said, you know, we want to start it with a big production number with all sorority girls, and we want Elle Woods' dog to come out center stage and tell the audience where Elle Woods is. And I looked at the director. I said, what do you mean tell us? He said, well, the dog has lines. And I said, really? How many lines does he have? Oh, he's got 5 or 6. And the director—
Were they imagining like,
yeah,
lines?
Yes,
or?
Yes.
Okay.
And the director, Jerry Mitchell, who's an old friend of mine, award-winning director, really thought this would be a way to get the audience involved in this fantasy of a wonderful story. And so I had to find a Chihuahua who would bark center stage in front of an orchestra and 2,000 people, you know. So I had to find the most outgoing, loudest Chihuahua you can imagine and then teach him how to do it sequentially, you know, to lines. And, you know, and the thing was, you know, in casting that dog, I didn't find a dog and teach him how to bark. What we did was we found a dog who barked all the time and taught him how to shut up. You know?
With a Chihuahua, that sounds difficult. I've known some – back when I lived next to the Irish Wolfhound, the other side was a Chihuahua, and it was a study in contrast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, so again, those are the sort of things that – that's an example of the creators coming to me with their vision and then me casting the dog, finding the dog with the right personality to convey the story they want to tell.
Well, and from what you said before, the dog's performance is going to be typically cued in a lot of important ways and regulated in certain ways by the other actors on stage. Does that mean that the actors have to get cast once the dog has been cast? I mean, or do you just have to hope that they're going to be able to work well together and adjust if things aren't working as rehearsal begins?
You would think that in major productions, casting directors – will say to people, you're working with a dog character. Are you allergic or afraid? I can't tell you how many times that I've shown up to the first day of rehearsal because I'm not invited to auditions. And the actors are like, oh, yeah, I'm not really fond of dogs.
What?
I have no choice but to look at the director and producer and say, well, then you're not going to get the performance. I mean, you can't teach a person who hasn't grown up with animals that inherent love and empathy. In 8 weeks, you know, so then it becomes a performance of some really high-end treats in someone's pocket that the dog is staring at the whole time. So, and because of Winn-Dixie, not only was I invited to auditions because the little girl who handled this dog had to be exemplary at it. You know, we picked these young women who are just wonderful, and then we do a boot camp with them. We actually spend at least 2 weeks prior to the first day of rehearsal. Them living with the dog, them doing all this basic training and creating that bond and relationship. That's a little much because of, again, this type of show. But when we do work, you know, a half hour to an hour every day of rehearsal is spent bonding the dog and the human that they're going to be working with together. And they have to work that into our rehearsal schedule.
Yeah. Yeah.
And on a movie, you don't do that. On a movie, right. You just show up and stand behind Julia Roberts. give the dog commands.
Stay out of the camera.
Exactly.
Yeah. This is always an impolitic question, but what does it cost to get a dog like this in a show? Are they just getting regular actor scale rates? Or I assume it's more expensive to have a highly trained animal, canine actor on stage.
Yes. It is more expensive than a chorus person. But let me break that down. Someone who's working in New York City on a Broadway show can take mass transit. We can't. So right there, you know, an Uber is $40 to $50 one way, you know, to show. So you're looking at $100 a day to transport the dog to the show. Our farm is in Connecticut. When we get a performance here in New York, we have to come up with housing. And housing is very expensive. Apartments are very expensive in New York City that accept animals. So you're looking at $3,000 or $4,000 a month for housing. There's a trainer involved, someone who provides that constant 24-hour care, someone who, you know, shows up at the show. I mean, I do the training. I usually set it up, and then I move on to the next show and put a handler in, you know. They're making $1,000 a week. There's all the expenses and then the year of preparation to get that dog to the first day of rehearsal that we have to amortize our costs, you know, to get there. So, you know, when you see an animal performance, it's not just people relate it to a human performance, but there's so much else that goes into preparing for it that it does cost more money. But here's the interesting thing. There's no unions or there's no for animals or animal handlers, both in film and on movies. So while everybody else in the on a Broadway theater, the ushers, the janitors, the actors, the musicians, the stagehands, the box office, they're all unionized. I'm the only non-union entity, animal trainers. So producers tend to keep our wages low and there's no health benefits. There's no insurance. There's no anything that goes along with it. It's a straight – they give me a straight check, a rental, flat fee for everything. The dog gets sick. It all comes out of our profits. So it's not as lucrative as you would think, which is why we have 31 performing dogs to who all work together to pay the mortgage every month on the farm. So it's you would think that our uniqueness would be able to make us name our price. But because of the fact that there's no unions, they just keep animal trainers bidding against each other to keep the rates low.
Interesting.
It's a labor of love, that's for sure.
Yeah.
The other thing that people should recognize about animals, working animals in the entertainment industry, is not only are there no unions, but there's no laws protecting them. You know, there is a wonderful group called the American Humane Association, which has a division in which they send representatives to movie sets to supervise. And that's when you see that disclaimer, no animals were harmed in this film. But there is – they only come to maybe 5% of the jobs that happen. And so, you know, I always want people to – the public – to be aware of that so that if you're watching something, a film or a show, and you see an animal panting or looking distressed, say something about it. Because us as animal trainers, if we refuse to do a performance, we never get hired again, you know, and we don't have anything to back up what would be humane treatment for animals. I fortunately at a very young age sort of set my career when I was 20 years old. And so I could set standards for my animals and have been able to keep them up because of my celebrity. But, you know, there's a lot of animal trainers who don't have that pull or that. So, you know, again, I just want people, if you feel like an animal has been harmed on a film or in a stage presentation, please say something. Because the last thing producers want to do is have their audience upset. And because if more people spoke up, if we brought more light onto what actually happens backstage, I think animals would have a better time of it.
Is it common that animals are mistreated in these contexts?
I consider animals who are under a lot of stress being abused. You know, causing undue stress to any creature. You wouldn't do that to an – I say on set, would you put an infant baby in that situation? And people are going, no. If the baby was crying, we'd take it away. Okay, if an animal is panting, if it's whining, if it's trying to get away, why do we have to force it to get a shot? You know, the most recently there was the movie A Dog's Purpose, a wonderful story about, you know, dog empowerment. And there was that whole scandal about – how they had not treated one of their German Shepherds well. And I couldn't believe that they allowed that to happen on that film, you know, knowing what the film was about. So it inexperienced people who are doing this to try and earn a living, whose back's against the wall, who are too afraid to say, can we take a break or I'm not going to do that without any ramification, happens more often than people think.
How long is a theatrical canine career typically?
Until they get arthritic or some other disease sets in. Imagine your pet at home. Come home, they're happy to see you, they play, they go for walks. Right. And then imagine our dogs who have that same lifestyle, but then they go to the theater and all these people love them and all these people play with them and they go different places and, you know, they tour the country and they, you know, they come home to the farm and they're bored. They're yeah. like, we want to have all that fun, all those people. And they, if you do it right, that's what they really like working. And it's sad when they physically can't do the like when a Sandy dog retires and they can't do that show anymore. It's sad because they get depressed. They see the younger dogs leaving and they're not going anymore. But they're, you know, it's the good thing with us is we, because we work in films, sometimes the older dogs, we can get them a job in a show that requires an old dog. Like there's a play, a John Steinbeck play called Of Mice and Men. And in it, there's a dog who is old and decrepit and they take him out back and shoot him. You know, and all the dog does is walk on stage on a leash and limps off. You know, I mean, I can't tell you. It's like you would think we were giving these dogs a second look at life to bring them back to a theater to show up and get all that attention. And, you know, so the bigger
grim
the
scenario to recreate. Though.
Yeah. I mean, the bigger the dog, the shorter the lifespan, you know. So a 100-pound dog is going to retire at 6 or 7 years old. Our Cairn Terriers, who play Toto in The Wizard of Oz, they'll live to 20 years old. They retire around 12, 14 years old. You know, they're they're still have that stamina. So it's usually about 3/4 of the way through their lifespan that they physically can't do that active work.
And then when they retire, are they just living on the farm with the other pups?
And they're just living on the farm with the other pups. And then, you know, we try to do things so that they still think they're vital. You know, we try to give the old ones some training. We take them out. You know, it's called an enrichment when you enrich a dog's life to make sure that they're still being socialized. And we pay close attention to the ones who are older and retired.
Mm-hmm. What's it like having these 31 dogs? This is the question that's been sticking with me this whole time. What's it like having 31 dogs? I mean, on what I assume is a pretty large property, all hanging out together. I called you on the phone a few days ago and I could hear one or two barking in the background. But what kind of relationships do these theatrical dogs form with one another in that context?
We did a reality show and it wasn't Hoarders. It was for Discovery Family Channel. And it's actually called From Wags to Riches with Bill Berlone. It was a family-oriented reality show about pet training. And Discovery thought because we rescued and we had this beautiful lifestyle, we'd be good role models for people who have dogs. And so you could see our crazy lifestyle. And our house is designed so that there's a central living area for humans, and then there are wings, effectively what are large rec rooms, you know, off the main area. And they live in packs based on their size or their breed. You know, so they live with us. You know, every 4 hours we open the back door and they all go out in the yard and run around and go to the bathroom, come back in. We feed them twice a day. We work with them. So it's this – it's like living in a commune, you know, and I'm married. I have one daughter who's now in college. But it was just like a big, crazy, weird family, you know. And if they're content, they're quiet. And people are amazed when they come to the house at how – quiet it actually is until somebody rings the doorbell, you know. Then everybody erupts in barking. But it's just like, I don't know. I've been doing it for 40 years, so I'm somewhat used to caretaking four-legged creatures, two-legged creatures, and just one big crazy family.
It does sound like it would be a little less dramatic than what you would get if you put 31 actors in the same house.
Oh yes, to live together. Oh yes. You know, but again, they're not dog aggressive, but when you have 80-pound dogs like Bodhi, you know, walking through the room with little chihuahuas, the chihuahuas don't appreciate being stepped on, you know, and you know, the terriers are always moving and Bodhi doesn't like all that activity. I mean, so they're grouped. So, you know, with like-minded canine actors. So they all sort of do the same thing as opposed – and you know, you could bring them all out together and they would all hang, but you just have to supervise them, you know, so they don't annoy one another.
Well, we'll look out for your work in the films and on stage. Thank you so much for joining us today.
No, thank you for bringing us all these wonderful dog jobs. And, you know.
Our pleasure.
All right.
And delight. Thank you so much, Bill.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Working. I'm Jacob Brogan. This week, we want to tell you about another great Slate show, one you may already listen to, but if you don't, you need to check out the Slate Culture Gabfest. For 10 years now, Dana Stevens, Julia Turner, and Stephen Metcalf have been deconstructing the week in culture from Taylor Swift to Martin Heidegger and everything in between. On the recent Redneck Margarita edition, the panel discussed the politics of Black Panther, how the return of Queer Eye for the Straight Guy fares in the post-gay marriage world, and what the hell is up with the New York Times op-ed page. The Slate Culture Gabfest every Wednesday morning, wherever you get your podcasts. Also, a quick note to let you know that Slate Live is thrilled to present Employee of the Month, a late-night talk show about work recorded in front of a live audience. Each month, host Katie Lazarus, who is, and this is totally true, is a real-life friend of mine. I love Katie. She is funny. She is smart. And her show is delightful. Each month, Katie shares the stage with people who interest and inspire her most for candid conversations about the work that they do. This month, she'll be joined by comedian Hannibal Buress, actor Emily Mortimer, and musical guest Resistance Revival Choir. The show is March 15th at the Gramercy Theater in New York City. I live in D.C., I'm going to try to make it up because I love Katie and I love her show. So if you want to come hang out with me there, maybe I'll be there. Send me an email. For more information and tickets, visit slate.com/live. Here at Working, we also want to say that we love getting emails from you. You can write to us via working@slate.com. I read those. I try to respond to them. Sometimes we get great suggestions through there. We also always would love it if you would rate and review the show on iTunes, especially if you like the show. This episode, we want to thank Anne Love for suggesting that we talk to Bill Berlone, who was delightful, and we're so grateful to Anne. This episode of Working was produced and edited by Benjamin Frisch.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.